I'm Lauren Schiller, and today on Inflection Point.
At the time, the San Francisco and national newspapers and magazines declared this is, you know, the breakup of the biggest slave girl ring in San Francisco.
Stay with us. You know this show is all about women rising up, and today's guest has made a career of studying what it takes. As a journalist, she's reported from a dozen countries and written for The Wall Street Journal and Business Week. And as a historian, she's published three books with the common theme of women and power, like this one.
I wrote a book called The House of Mondavi, which was about four generations of a Napa Valley wine family. It starts with Mama Rosa in the kitchen. As chairman of the board, she was cooking for everybody, but not actually running the board. It ends with her granddaughter casting the deciding vote in a billion-dollar takeover. So an incredible arc in terms of women's power.
She wrote a book about a princess's quest to restore a Hawaiian palace's lost treasures.
The next book I wrote was about Queen Liliʻuokalani of Hawaii and about her unexpected rise to power. She assumed the monarchy of Hawaii, and she was quickly deposed from that role. However, she exerted incredible, what we call now, soft power. She was an incredible composer. She had a cultural legacy that exists to this day through songs such as Aloha Oe.
And now, Julia Flynn Seiler has written about women who would seem to have had no power at all.
And this book is a book about essentially an unknown women's story. And it focuses on a rescue home that is not far from here. It's right across the bay on 920 Sacramento Street in San Francisco's Chinatown. And the thousands of women who pass through its doors over the period of time from the 1870s to the 1930s. And one of the questions is that historians grapple with and journalists grapple with is how do you write about vulnerable people and vulnerable women in particular who didn't leave much record behind? And that is true for many of those women who came through the doors of this home, and that's what I tried to do, is tell their stories. And I chose a few of the stories to focus on.
The book is called The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. Our conversation took place at a live event for the Bay Area Book Festival in Berkeley, California, as part of their Women Lit programming. And while this is a special episode, it ties in perfectly with our focus this season on people taking action to make radical change for the better. The people Julie and I talk about, and Julia Flynn Seiler does go by Julie, just happen to have lived in 19th century San Francisco's Chinatown. I started by asking Julie about the common thread running through her books of women and power, and the power of the pen, why it's important for her to write about women at all.
I do write about women and power, and I particularly like to tackle stories from a feminist perspective. We are starting to look at history in a different way, and we are starting to realize that women can exert power. The key women that I focus on were 19th century women who didn't have the right to vote and who were mostly confined to the home, not the public sphere, yet they exercised power in the way that was open to them, which is through a charitable process of founding a home. And unintentionally or intentionally, they ended up moving into the public sphere and being pioneers in the fight against slavery, against sex slavery.
So it seems like I'm sensing a trend around understanding our history is a little different than the way we were taught in school. I'd say most of us in this room were taught a pretty rote set of historical narratives that are being disrupted now by women writers and by writers who are talking about women throughout history that did have a role or did make change that was previously unheard of. So what do you think it will take to get more of that out there? And what is in the way of that?
Well, first of all, I think that we need more women writers of history. We have incredible models out there right now. Jill Lepore is doing incredible work at Harvard, and Most of you are familiar with her Wonder Woman, but of course she also wrote the book Book of Ages, and that was based on the life of Jane Franklin, Ben Franklin's sister. Almost no written record behind. She excavated this life that we had not known about before, and I thought that was incredibly inspiring. So we need more women historians. We need more journalists who are women who start looking for untold stories like this. And I think that White Devil's Daughters is a story that's an inspiring story of women working together. And maybe this will inspire some other people to start digging around.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about San Francisco in the 19th century, because my impression of San Francisco has always been that, hey, this is such a progressive city. We've got all these amazing, you know, we're the first to pass these certain laws and, you know, and make change for people who are, you know, on the margins. And as I read your book, I realized that that has not always been the case. So paint a picture for us of what was going on in the time period that you covered.
Well, San Francisco in the early, mid-19th century was such a wild place, crazy place. If you were on the streets, they were cobbled streets. If they were cobbled, they were often muddy streets with gas lamps. The first cable cars came into the city in the 1870s. But there were very few women on the streets. And the women you saw on the streets, particularly in the 8-block area around Chinatown, would be prostitutes, at least according to the census takers at the time. In the 1870 census, there were approximately one woman for every 10 men in Chinatown. And according to those census takers, and scholars have argued over this a bit, but that's the best we have, more than 71% of those women were prostitutes or somehow working the sex trade. So it was a place where that was not very friendly to Chinese people and very unfriendly to women for the most part.
And there was, I was just introduced to a book that was written around that time called The Chinese Must Go. And then I read that phrase actually in your book, that was a sentiment that was, you know, kind of underpinning almost everything. So the whole community was kind of under siege, not just the dearth of women.
Yes, there was widespread racism in the there were what was known as the Sandlot riots. There was violence against the Chinese. There's a number of scholars at this point who are doing incredible work about the lynchings and violence against the Chinese across the West, and that certainly was taking place in the Bay Area during that time.
So meanwhile, one of the ways that the Chinese residents could grab a little bit of power and gain a little bit of wealth was, unfortunately, through these human trafficking rings. And could you describe the tongs?
Yes. Tong is a Chinese word for an organization, and not all tongs are criminal tongs. So let's distinguish, to clarify that. I think the criminal tongs, however, saw a business opportunity that was based in part on the gender discrepancy in San Francisco, Chinatown, and elsewhere at that point. And there was a great demand for sex. And they recognized that they could import Chinese women or Asian women to San Francisco to supply that demand. And what's really shocking and surprising in the historical record is the degree to which the municipal authorities and the police in San Francisco and elsewhere were supporting and actively protecting the human trafficking trade that was going on, to the point where there were women, large groups, 300, 400 women, would unload at the docks in the 1860s and 1870s, and they would be sold at the docks in auction form. And of course, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was passed in 1865, in the mid-1860s. So slavery had been outlawed in the United States, yet these open sales of women were taking place in San Francisco.
And the politicians and the police were just letting it slide.
They were profiting from it. So this was something that went on for decades, and there was a very small group of women, and these women were predominantly middle-class church ladies, who saw the suffering and saw the trafficking and saw the victims. The average victim of, or survivor, if they survived, of human trafficking during that time might live 4 or 5 years. And they saw the suffering in front of them, and despite the racism all around them, they said, this is wrong, and we're going to do something to fix this. And so they set up a home as a place for women to find their own freedom.
Well, just to touch back on the kind of the money to be made in this business, yes, to characterize it as a business, you write in the book that some of these women were being sold for $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. Which at that time, I mean, what is that in today's money? I mean,
it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. Yeah. And that, and then they had to earn it back at $10 to $20 a customer, right? So they would never, I mean, they would never get out of that.
No, almost, they often would not get out of it. They would suffer from venereal diseases, suffer from sexual violence, and many of them did not survive that situation.
So the home that was set up, let's talk about Dolly Cameron, or Donaldina Cameron, who I understand, it seems like she came to San Francisco kind of, well, she was a child, yes, and she sort of ended up staying by accident, in a way, right? Can you give us the whole story of this woman, Dolly, who has changed the face of trafficking in Chinatown?
Yes, she was the daughter, the youngest daughter of a Scottish sheep herding family. And her family arrived in San Francisco. They'd had a kind of roundabout trip. They had a sheep farm in the Highlands, and then they went to New Zealand, and then they ended up in California. And I actually found the passenger records. When they landed in San Francisco, I believe it was 1872 on Christmas Eve. And Dolly at that point was a toddler when she first came to the city. She only spent one night in the city at that point. The family moved around. It had a ranch in the Central Valley, and then her father ended up going to work for Lucky Baldwin. I don't know if anyone here is familiar with him, but he was a larger-than-life California figure in the Southern California area. And Dolly's mother died when she was very, very young, and her father died shortly after that. So the other siblings really raised Dolly. And Dolly had a rough time of it. And during that period of time in the 1880s, 1890s, there weren't very many opportunities for employment for a middle-class woman. And there was a family friend who said, well, we've got this project in San Francisco, and I think you would be a perfect sewing teacher for this project. And Dolly at that point was in her mid-20s, and she had had an unfulfilled plan to marry a man, and so she decided she didn't have a lot of choices. So she came to San Francisco's Chinatown, went to work as a sewing teacher in 1895, and I think it is a very safe bet that she had absolutely no idea what she was walking into as she took the steps up into that house. And very quickly she realized this was a home for vulnerable girls and women, many of whom were deeply traumatized, some of whom had been repeatedly raped. And she had to get her head around this very, very quickly because it was a situation she had not anticipated.
So the home was started by somebody else through one of the local churches.
Yes. Yes, it was founded by a group of church women led by the ministers' wives. They were outraged by the suffering they saw on the part of girls and women who had been trafficked and who were in Chinatown. And so they'd started to set up essentially a safe house so these girls and women would have some place to go that was safe. The Methodists, these were Presbyterian women. Methodist women had set up a safe house even before they had. And there was a little rivalry to try to convert people to the different Christian faiths. What my research showed me was that the conversion rate was actually quite low, But the homes did provide food, shelter, and education. Some of the women and girls who came through there, this was the first place that they got any education at all.
And they were, I mean, some of them found their way to the home on their own by daring escapes. And some of them were actually rescued, entering through the sunroof. And lower, like, I mean, can you tell that story? You'll tell it so much better than me. But
of course, I'd be happy to.
Wrapping a rope around the waist and descending 25 feet.
That's one of the most astonishing stories. So this is a story that involves Dolly Cameron right at the beginning of the 20th century. And at that period of time, San Francisco's Chinatown was threatened with an outbreak of bubonic plague. And plague had erupted at first in Honolulu, and then it was cropping up in San Francisco. So in the middle of the night, the police put ropes around about an 8-block area of Chinatown and prevented people. The next morning, they would wake up, and they couldn't go in, and they couldn't go out. So the rescue home, 920 Sacramento Street, was just a few blocks outside of the quarantine zone. And Dolly had gotten a note from a girl that she knew saying, "My sister's desperately ill, we need your help." And Dolly had gotten to know the community pretty well by then. She had been working in the home at that point for five years. And so, but she would not be permitted like other people to get past the quarantine lines. So she disguised herself. She had bright auburn hair. And she covered it up with a dark scarf, and she wore dark clothes, and she called on a friend in Chinatown who let her into his cellar or somehow climbed up through the shop onto the roof, through a skylight onto the roof, and then clambered down and found the girl and her sister, realized the girl needed medical help, climbed back out beyond the quarantine lines, and managed to get a medical group with an ambulance to come in and rescue the girl. The girl sadly died, but her sister stayed with the home for several years afterwards and was very grateful for that help.
So let's talk about, what were they up against? I mean, aside from a corrupt a corrupt political and police situation.
Oh, they faced a number of threats over the years. Of course, during the Barbary Plague, which my former Wall Street Journal colleague, Marilyn Chase calls it, during that period of time, there was an obvious kind of epidemiological threat or a health threat to the women who worked at the home. There were other types of health threats because they lived in a large group home with as many as 60 young girls, women, babies crammed into these bedrooms. And so flu would come through the home and everybody would get sick, or measles, or, you know, whatever it might be. But in addition to those types of health threats, there were very physical and very frightening threats. Shortly after Dolly arrived at the home in 1895, somebody had placed bombs around the home. And that's well documented. The papers picked up on it. The bombs weren't detonated. They were found before they could go off. The women who founded the home were spat at. They were, the girls and young women, when they left the home, were always escorted because of the fear that traffickers would try to snatch them back, essentially. The home was guarded. There was a guard at the front. There were bars on many of the windows to keep men and criminal tong members from trying to take the girls and women back.
And they were also up against a financial challenge constantly, right? I mean, Dolly was traveling the country all the time looking for money for $10 here and $200 there.
Yes, yes, or, you know, three jars of jam and a beautiful shawl. I mean, the gifts were really interesting going through old church records to find out what people gave. But I think there's a lot of resonance with nonprofits today, which is, it was hand to mouth. I mean, they were trying to support as many as 50 or 60 people living in this home and had almost no money. And so Dolly became the face of the anti-trafficking movement at that time and was a very effective fundraiser. And she would particularly tap kind of high society people. So the mission home on the edge of Chinatown at Sacramento Street is literally in the shadow of the Fairmont Hotel. It's right below Nob Hill. And Dolly would go up to Nob Hill and go to the parlors and go to the beautiful teas hosted by elegant society women. And she was pretty good at raising money.
So it's interesting. Okay, so as the face of the anti-trafficking movement, that was much later as more and more support was being built for the work that she was doing. But at the beginning, she's just, you know, this woman who came in to teach sewing lessons and eventually became the director of the home. And, I mean, in her way, this was a very radical action. I mean, this was against all the social norms, you know, taking care of people that nobody wanted to even recognize the existence of, or if they did, they wanted them to leave. And, you know, I think today we think about radical action as being, it has to become a movement, it has to become a political change, it has to become a policy, it has to change the law. But meanwhile, she's just sort of trucking along, you know, doing this work, the hard work every single day of what you told me, radical empathy.
Yes.
So can you talk, I mean, what have you learned in the work that you've done for both this book and I guess for all of the work that you've done around what creates the spark in that person to just keep them going?
I really think that is the heart of this book. And that's the key question I was trying to answer. Why do people make a leap of empathy to reach out to people who are vulnerable, who are scorned, who the rest of society looks down on? And the answers, as in most things, are very, very complex. The women who worked, particularly the women who worked inside the home, they had faith. That's one thing. You point out that they were doing something that was so opposed to what the rest of their culture and their society was saying to them. The papers during that time were filled with anti-Chinese invective. It was a very racist place. So what motivated them? I think it's a funny thing with Dolly Cameron, and I'll just look at her story for a moment first. She didn't have a lot of other choices, and she suffered on her path to finding her way through this home. She experienced the death of her mentor, her boss, very early on when she arrived at the home, and that led her to what we today would call a mental breakdown, which is very understandable. There were deaths constantly. There were tragedies constantly. She lived in a tiny, tiny room that the closet was so small there was only room for two pairs of shoes. She lived incredibly modestly. And she did have to take breaks over the years because it was exhausting, grinding work. That said, there were some friendships and relationships she built within the home that sustained her. And one of the most beautiful things that I found in going through Cameron family records as well as archives from Yale to the wonderful Bancroft Library to elsewhere were all of these notes that the women and girls over the years had written to her, referring to her as mother, as Lomo, old one, and Mother's Day cards to her. So I think it was profound that, for example, and I know we're probably going to get to this, Lauren, but that she's buried in the same plot as a girl named Teen Fu Wu, who arrived 15 months before she did, and who had been sold into slavery by her father in China to pay his gambling debts. And they became friends. Their friendship lasted for six decades, and they worked together for four or five decades. And so I think those personal relationships with other women and other girls really sustained the workers at that home.
The other thing that I thought was really interesting is that she did, Dolly did have a few powerful people on her side, which made it possible for her to continue the work. Eventually, there was someone named Jack Mannion, who was the head of the Chinese division of the police force. There was a shipping magnate. There's a newspaper man. I mean, these are all men who saw the work that she was doing and were trying to find ways that they could bring where they had power to her. So can you talk about how either she cultivated these relationships or, you know, what you learned about each of these guys that made them feel compelled to participate in the work that she was doing?
She was extremely adept at cultivating allies, people in powerful places. She was in the courts very often, as were the other workers at the home. There was a phalanx of lawyers who volunteered for the home and would support the work that they did. Jack Mannion was the head of what was known as the Chinatown Squad, and he would accompany her sometimes as they sought to help vulnerable girls and women. And in terms of there were some very, very crucial, what we now call corporate relationships. So you noted the shipping magnate. He ran the most important steamship line between China and San Francisco. And they were Presbyterians, and I don't know if she charmed them or how they built the relationship, but he funded a second home for the younger girls, which is in Oakland. It was called the Ming Kwan Home. It is now on the Mills College campus.
And that Julia Morgan designed that building.
Yes, right? And Julia Morgan was another ally, yeah, female ally in that sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I want to go back to the women that ended up thriving in the home and ultimately coming back and helping make it a success for the other girls and women that were in it. Because I feel like one of the pitfalls of this kind of story is that the criticism might be, well, this is just another white savior narrative. And it sounds to me like there were a couple situations where there was actually an opportunity for one of the former home residents, Chinese woman, to take over. And she declined because of, well, explain why, actually. Because it seems like that was something that Dolly Cameron wanted to cultivate.
Yes, yes. So this goes back to the relationship she had with a woman named Teen Fu Wu. She was known, she's still known. People who knew her are still alive and helped me with the book. She was known as Auntie Wu. And Auntie Wu, or Teen, worked very closely with Dolly from basically the 1920s up until the late 1930s when Dolly stepped away. And Dolly wanted Teen to take the job of superintendent of the home. And I worked very, you know, in great deal of depth in the Presbyterian Historical Society archives. One good thing about writing about a mission home is they keep great records of everything. And I found letters that were so touching in which Cameron is promoting Teen and suggesting she should have this job. And in turn, Auntie Wu or Teen saying, no, I don't want to take this job. And in fact, what happened was that Auntie Wu went to live next to Dolly Cameron at the end of her days. But it was such an interesting thing to discover that a Chinese woman had been promoted by Cameron as the head, but more importantly, I tried to focus on the book of how the white women in the home absolutely could not have done their work without the Chinese women who worked beside them. I mean, I really see this as a cross-cultural story. Most of the white women in the home didn't speak Chinese. They needed Chinese translators, and they didn't have the kind of cultural knowledge or sensitivity to deal with traumatized, mostly Chinese, but sometimes Japanese girls and women as they came through.
Well, let's talk about some of the women who lived in the home and whose talents were recognized. Let's talk about Bessie Wong.
Oh, I love Bessie Wong. She's such a wonderful, wonderful character, and I think her family is still around. So Bessie's story is a very fascinating one. She was up at the border between California and Oregon living with her sister, and she basically found her father was about to take her back to China and encourage a marriage at the age of 14 that she did not want. She wanted to continue her education. And she had heard about the mission home. Her sister had been writing to Dolly Cameron over the years. And Bessie ran away to the home. And this is in the, this must have been about 1916, 1915. And she did very, very well there, perhaps in part because she wasn't coming from a situation where she had been physically abused or endured sexual abuse. She absolutely rocketed and embraced the education and that was offered to her. And there's all sorts of very interesting correspondence between Dolly Cameron and, for example, Stanford University, encouraging them to admit Bessie. And Bessie got to Stanford, and which is astonishing in itself, and was struggling. And so the women of the home figured out a way to pay for tutors to help her get through. And it was so wonderful to find Bessie Yeung's yearbook photograph from 1927. She was the first Chinese woman to graduate from Stanford. But that's not really the only story. The other part of it is that she then went on to medical school, and she was a pioneer in terms of being a Chinese woman. I think she was maybe one of the first Chinese women to work in a major medical hospital in Los Angeles, and she really had to fight to get there. She ended up coming back to work with Donaldina and to work with some of the children in particular. But she then had a medical practice. She married late in life a very prominent Chinese man. And her story is just an incredible story, I think.
There are many women in this book whose stories are, you can't believe that they managed to get from point A to point B. But I guess the sort of this theme of it takes a village definitely comes into play here. But was Bessie the woman that also, in working with the hospital, that didn't want to even hire a Chinese person, let alone a Chinese woman, then helped set up a program that brought in more Chinese physicians into that hospital? Is that the Bessie Wong story?
Yes,
as well?
That's the Bessie Yeung story as well. Yes.
So the rings of of goodness radiate outward,
and modest goodness too. Another woman that I'd love to tell you about is a Japanese woman, and one of the struggles that feminist scholars and feminist writers have is to find the stories of women who did not leave much in the public record, and that's very true with women who have been trafficked, have been involved with sex work. But there's one woman who just seared my eyes when I read some of her accounts. So this was a Japanese woman named Yamada Waka. She had been trafficked from Japan to Seattle into its notorious brothel zone. And she became a pretty famous prostitute at that point, forced into prostitution. She ended up escaping the situation with the help of a journalist and came down to San Francisco. Tragically, the man that she thought was trying to help her, in fact, was planning to force her to work in prostitution in San Francisco as well. So she fled to the mission home. She had heard about it. Now, when she arrived at the mission home, she was, our best guess is that she was illiterate. She did not know how to read, at least English, if not Japanese. She was brilliant, apparently, and quickly learned to not only read English, but to write beautifully. She ended up going to an extra school and marrying the man who was her tutor, a Japanese tutor, and they left San Francisco just before the earthquake struck in 1906. So Yamada Waka then in Japan became a leading feminist writer and wrote about her experience as being trafficked, sex slavery. And she wrote the most astonishing accounts of this. They're very, very powerful. Not only that, but when she got back to Japan, she set up a home similar to the mission home that she'd found her freedom in Japan for other women who were vulnerable and seeking refuge. And it's quite an incredible story. She ended up being invited to the White House in 1934. I found a photograph of her where she saw Eleanor Roosevelt, and she's wearing a formal kimono. And it's pretty incredible story.
This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. You're listening to my conversation with author and journalist Julia Flynn Seiler about her book, The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. We spoke in May of 2019 at the Bay Area Book Festival as part of their Women Lit programming. Subscribe to the Inflection Point podcast and contribute to support our production at inflectionpointradio.org. After the break...
At the time, the San Francisco and national newspapers and magazines declared this is, you know, the breakup of the biggest slave girl ring in San Francisco.
We'll be right back. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. You're listening to my conversation with Julia Flynn Seiler. We spoke at the Bay Area Book Festival in May of 2019 about her book, The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. In the book, Julie tells the stories of the leaders of the Occidental Mission Home in San Francisco, who provided shelter and education for thousands of previously enslaved and vulnerable young Chinese women and girls. There was actually retribution. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but one of the stories that you tell in the book is how there was this incredible court case where there was enough evidence to finally bring one of the leaders of one of the Tongs to trial. Yes. Twice. And I think you should share that because it feels like it's a sort of a more widespread, I don't know, it makes it feel like the work that she was doing in the home that probably over her whole time helped maybe 1,000 or so women?
Well, I did a lot of work to try to tally up the number of women, and one of the things that I had the opportunity to do was to work in the private records of 920 Sacramento Street. And they still have private records dating back to the 1870s there, which is amazing, including handwritten logbook. So every woman, every child who came into that home, passed through the doors between the 1870s and the logbook goes up to the 1910s, was recorded in this. Overall, we estimate 3,000 women and girls, and even some boys, came through that home. And in terms of how many were touched in some way by Dolly Cameron when she was the superintendent, close to 1,000.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so ultimately, when there was finally a court case against one of the leaders of the Tongs, that was also responsible for bringing in thousands of women and putting them into slavery, it seemed like an opportunity to have an even larger impact. So can you talk a bit about, tell us the story of that trial and then the one after that.
Sure. So it was known as the Broken Blossoms trial. And in the 1930s, it was a famous trial. It got splashed over the, you know, true crime magazines across the country. And it was a very well-known trial. And I start the book, in fact, with one of the women who ends up testifying at the trial, running from a beauty shop on Jackson Street to the Mission Home at 920 Sacramento Street. And she's running for her freedom. And then I stop this section there. And then at the end of the book, we catch up with her. And we've learned she's pregnant when she makes that run. And then we realize that she was not the only one who had been trafficked by the same man who had a shop on Grant Street, a hardware store. Ostensible hardware store. He was a criminal Tong leader. I tracked his journey from China to San Francisco through a number of court records and immigration records, and he first arrived in the 1910s, and it's very hard to estimate how many women he probably trafficked, but many, many, many women. This trial was, which took place, two trials, which took place in the mid-1930s, involved testimony by several women who had been trafficked. and they told very, very similar stories. And as a historian, there were a lot of court documents about this and immigration records to work with. And there had been some excellent work done on this trial before by, for example, the historian Eddie Wong. But the first time around, the traffickers' very powerful phalanx of lawyers intimidated the young woman who was testifying against him. Second time around, they found one or two other women who were willing to testify, and they were stronger, and they ended up convicting him. And at the time, the San Francisco and national newspapers and magazines declared this is, you know, the breakup of the biggest slave girl ring in San Francisco.
So it's probably worth mentioning that human trafficking is still a huge problem today. I actually was curious how much of a problem and found a report that was put out by the city of San Francisco that globally trafficking represents $150 billion market annually. And that California is a top site for it, mostly because you can get here by sea. and I'm wondering, I mean, that's just kind of an overwhelming number. What can we learn from history that could be applied to today's situation? I mean, you know, Dolly Cameron's one woman in one city and one, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can certainly pose questions. How do we reach out to people who otherwise don't have a voice? At the time of the women who came together for this home, as I mentioned, they didn't have the vote. They had virtually no political power. Most of them didn't have any economic power. But they managed to gain power by working together and, in some senses, shaming people and raising the public attention and putting the spotlight on what was then known as the slave trade, but we now know as human trafficking. And I think that there's such good work being done now by the many, many nonprofits devoted to fighting human trafficking, putting spotlights on it. And, you know, and I also think that we're in a period right now where there's so much racial division that the story of these women who crossed those racial and class boundaries was one that was very inspiring to me. And perhaps we can learn about trying to reach across our own boundaries and not accepting the kind of hatred and kind of racism that's still so endemic in our society.
I've got a couple of question cards up here. If anyone has questions, wave your hand in the air, and one of these lovely ladies in white will come collect them and bring them up so we can start to hear from you. Okay, so let me start with what I have in front of me. Well, I think we covered this a little bit, but perhaps it's worth expanding on. So this story is usually handled as a white, brave white woman story. In your research, have you encountered Chinese men or women involved in resisting this sex trade?
Well, actually, I'd love to answer that question straight on, because what my research found was this was a story very much of Chinese women and white women working together to fight the sex trade and to fight human trafficking. Those white women, white church women, could not have done their work without their Chinese friends and co-workers. And the story is very parallel in the rise of the Chinese American press, which focused on a number of the same issues that she was fighting against. And one of the characters in the book is a man named Ning Pun Chu, who started off in the Presbyterian Church, quit as a minister, and said, hey, you know, I'm starting a newspaper instead because I kind of have a lot more power as a newspaper man.
So where did the women go when they left the home? What kinds of education did they get? And what was the end goal for these women?
Okay, let's start with what kind of education. So the home offered education to everybody who lived in the home. And some of it was religious education. Some of it was very basic education, how to read and write. Where did they go? They went many different places. The home was a de facto marriage bureau. There are Chinese families across the United States where somebody, one of the women, the mother of the family, had come through the home at some point. And as the time progressed, there were fewer and fewer survivors of sex trafficking and sex slavery who were at the home. It became more of a social services agency, a place where people who needed some help for a short period of time could come and live and then find a safe place to go after that.
And what was the end goal for these women? Was it to go back to China or Japan or to stay in the U.S.? And what kind of job opportunities did they have?
Well, there were 3,000 girls and women who went through the home approximately, and the end goals were very different probably for every single individual. Some women did end up going back to China. China, particularly in the 30s, as all of you know, was in incredible turmoil. And so, for example, the character that I mentioned earlier, Auntie Wu or Teen Fu Wu, she did go back to China and looked for her family, couldn't find them, and came back to the home. That was really her only connection, only family that she had. However, other women, sometimes the immigration authorities would house Chinese women at 920 Sacramento Street before they were deported. And so they would live there for a short period of time and then go back to China or be forced to go back to China. Others would spread out all over the country. I mean, that was one of the pleasures of this book, because there are mission home girls, as they would call them, who are living in Minneapolis, who ended up in New York, who ended up in the Midwest, in Chicago. There's quite a diaspora of marriages and families. And certainly with the women who ran the home, the end goal was to create marriages, to create Chinese Christian families. And they looked for good Christian men to marry these women to. But my sense in going through many, many, many records is that the key thing was for the men to be gainfully employed and good people, not criminals.
You talk about the idea of radical empathy. I wonder, is that a quality that comes from someone that can relate to suffering? How do we make others more empathetic?
Oh, wow. I do think that the two characters I follow most closely that go the entire way through the book are Teen and Dolly, and both of them suffered a great deal in their personal lives. Both of them suffered the deaths of the people who were close to them. They suffered physical ailments. And I do think that suffering can make you more empathetic. And they had faith, too, and all kinds of, you know, different forms that takes. But somehow it gave them the foundation to get through very hard times and a lot of challenges and to reach out to people who needed help.
You mentioned Teen declined to carry on. What Chinese women did take the reins, either here or in China, and did they make any headway like Yamada?
There's another story that's quite a wonderful story, and I think her family is in the East Bay. She had the nickname Tiny, but her real name was Tai Leung, and she came to the home. She became one of the Chinese translators, and then she got a job as the first Chinese woman to work for the immigration authorities on Angel Island, and she ended up marrying a man named Schultz. Now, during that time, it was against the law. There was an anti-miscegenation laws, and it was against the law for them to marry in California, the white man and Chinese woman. So they went up to Seattle and got married instead. They came back down after they got married, and they both lost their jobs at Angel Island. And anyways, they made their way. They found other jobs. And one of the great discoveries and gifts of this project was the librarian at Berkeley's Asian Studies Library letting me take a look at the newly donated collection by the Schultz family, which included this big trunk full of amazing photographs and just incredible stuff. So that was really fun.
That was Julie Flynn Seiler speaking with me about her book, The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. We talked in May of 2019 at the Bay Area Book Festival as part of their Women Lit programming.
You can hear more of my live conversations and any past episodes you've missed at my website, inflectionpointradio.org, and everywhere podcasts are heard. This is Inflection Point. This is how women rise up. I'm Lauren Schiller. That's our Inflection Point for today. All of our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, Stitcher, Pandora, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the podcast. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, support our production with a monthly or one-time contribution and keep women's stories front and center. Just go to inflectionpointradio.org. We're on Facebook at Inflection Point Radio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter and Instagram at L.A. Schiller. To find out more about the guests you heard today and to sign up for our email newsletter, you know where to go, inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PR.